Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 17th of December. A delight to have you all here. And hey, it's Wednesday. I don't know. We were just having a small conversation in the office, saying that this week seems to be going slowly, and I think it's just because of the horrible news that has been happening. But hopefully, you know, things will pick up, and we'll see how it goes. But we have a lot to discuss this morning, and we'll do exactly that. We welcome you. For a litany of reasons, we were unable to present to you our billboard at the top of the hour to tell you what's coming up. So let me just take this moment to tell you that at 11 o'clock this morning, we are pleased, very, very pleased to offer to you Itzhak Perlman's Hanukkah radio party. How fun is that? oh my God! So it is. Of course, it's Hanukkah, and we've been over the years. We have always shared many, many programs for you. On Monday, we presented one with Mindy Ratner, and we'll have another one on Friday. But today, I think for the first time, we are playing Itzhak Perlman's Hanukkah radio party. It's at 11 o'clock, and it just sounds delightful. It's going to be music, and it's going to be stories. Some are serious, some are silly, and let's face it, besides being a brilliant, one of the most amazing violinists of all time, Itzhak Perlman is also a master storyteller, and he'll be telling great stories, and it should be a lovely, lovely morning at 11 o'clock. So that is sort of the bon mot after we talk about all the crap stuff. Right, exactly. Yes, cue the violinist. Let's go. Exactly. I agree. And so that's coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, and I'm more than a little tickled to have that on the air. All right. Let's get to introducing this wonderful panel that we have assembled here. Osman Ahmad is with us. Specialist in government and public services healthcare consulting. Second time on the program, which means the first must have went okay.
Thank you so much. Happy to be back.
It's very nice. I guess this is your third time on the program.
Second?
Okay, second. Wait a second time. Good. Well, it's really nice to have you on the show. Thank you very much for being here, as always. Jonathan Becker, Executive Vice President for Academic Affairs at Bard College and Director for the Center for Civic Engagement and Professor of Political Studies. Good morning, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm really glad to be here. I would say last night, while we did not have a party which could compete with Itzhak Perlman's, we at the Center for Civic Engagement held Smorgasbord, which included a Hanukkah celebration with the Bard Jewish Student Organization. And it was lovely to have 30 people. I myself made the latkes, trying to be a leader there. And it was a wonderful celebration, especially given all of the bad news over the past days.
Smorgasbord. I love that. That
you
is
can't
so
compete with
great.
Smorgasbord.
Roger, were you a part of Smorgasbord?
I wish. I want to have Jonathan's latkes, yeah.
Yes. Roger, also from Bard, founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights. And Roger Berkowitz, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
It's great to be here, Joe.
Thank you. Sarah Rogerson joins us, Albany Law School professor, director of the Edward Swire Justice Center at Albany Law School. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Very Hanukkah, nice. Everyone.
Yeah, happy Hanukkah.
Very nice to have you all here, and I thank you so much for taking the time out to be with us on these busy news days as we try to navigate what exactly is going on. A lot of different directions that we can go on. I'm going to try to start with one that is that we haven't talked about a whole lot this week, and that is that the president announced a complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers to Venezuela. In a Truth Social post, President Donald Trump also declared the government of President Maduro a foreign terrorist organization. This is a total and complete blockade of all sanctioned oil tankers entering or leaving Venezuela, a dramatic escalation in the months-long pressure campaign against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Such a blockade, which Trump revealed Tuesday evening on Truth Social, could devastate Venezuela's already struggling economy, which depends on overseas oil sales, primarily to China and often on sanctioned vessels. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America, Trump wrote. It will only get bigger, and the shock of them will be like nothing they have ever seen before. Until such time as they return to the United States of America, all of the oil, the land, and other assets that they have previously stolen from us. Trump declared the Venezuelan regime a foreign terrorist organization, FTO, and accused government officials of using oil to enrich themselves and finance drug terrorism. The step further escalates the pressure Trump has imposed on Venezuela as the U.S. tries to push Maduro to leave the country and threatens military action in Venezuela if he does not. That from the reporting from the Washington Post. Jonathan Becker, we'll start with you.
Yeah, it's... I think when we look at what's going on, first of all, I would say when you change the name of the Department of Defense and call it the Department of War, then you get a war. I think you're realizing what has been predicted before. I think this underlines the fact that the attacks on Venezuela are not about drugs, which has been the claim up until now, and that they're about assets and oil and who may control them. I think most importantly, it's a reflection of this new national security strategy that Trump announced, the administration announced at the end of November, which takes the focus off of Russia and China and looks at global balances of power and focuses on the Monroe Doctrine and what they call the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which is focusing on U.S. asserting its power within Latin America and in this hemisphere, and focuses on things like supply chains and access to resources. So I think it's a sort of a naked description of where the United States foreign policy is heading. And I think that we are in danger of not simply what will happen vis-a-vis Venezuela, but what will happen if Maduro actually left and what would happen to the country then, which is something which we're not talking about.
So when a lot of this seems, I guess what I'm having trouble with is how much did we sort of like scratch the itch here, like in the sense of that we're antagonizing to a bit to further the interests.
Well, look, I mean, I think the Trump administration operates on symbols, and this is a great symbol of, you know, the new America, which doesn't care about things like rights. We care about power and access to resources. So I don't know whether that would, I don't know also whether this is linked to the fact that the Epstein documents are meant to be released on Friday. It's a wonderful distraction. But it seems to be, if you read the national security strategy, it is aligned with that. It is aligned with what they're saying that we will do, which is assert authority over this hemisphere and place an emphasis on access to resources and supply chains. And that is what is going on. So I think it's much more dangerous. I would also say, the descriptions of America first, which did not suggest a projection of American foreign policy abroad, seem to not be realized through the actions there. So I think it's, you know, you want to have, as I was saying, the Department of War, what's called the Department of War, it's really the Department of Defense, wants to have, you know, some type of thing it could hold up to show that it is new business and it's the new Trump administration. And I'm afraid we might get what we claim we're seeking.
It's also an anti-socialist agenda. I was listening to some other commentary from The New Yorker, and the phrase, the way to Havana is through Caracas, the idea that the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela is so close, and Venezuela, of course, supplies a lot of oil to Cuba, that it's a state, it's, there's, there are two other, there are two things going on here, at least. And the idea is anti-socialism and aggression in a place that seems like an easy win for the Trump administration on that front.
I also wonder about the designation that has been given, the FTO. What does that mean? And what does that allow the administration to do? Because the attack on the boats was a very thinly veiled action, as we can now see, in terms of having that much power just off the coast of Venezuela, certainly signaling to the government that the United States was there, present, active, armed, and ready to intervene. And now we are seeing these next steps. So I'm also thinking about what that means and what that next step will be once Maduro, as well as other parties, have been given this designation. What does that allow the president to do legally as the next step?
Yeah.
Roger.
I think there's two parts that we've talked about. One is the policy part, and I think Jonathan is really right to set this up as part of the new U.S. policy. And, you know, people can go, oh, my God, but the truth is there's a rational policy here, whether you agree with it or not, right? To focus not on China and Russia and things you can't control, but on smaller countries in our and break the world up into spheres of power. This has very much been the argument of those who've been against our intervention in Russia and Ukraine for years, saying, look, that's Russia's sphere of power. Taiwan might be China's sphere of power, and there is a rationalist realpolitik view here that, is changing U.S. policy. And I think people are not talking about that as much as they should. And they're talking more about the sort of international law and humanitarian claims, which are not unimportant, but I think in the end will pale compared to the real shift. The other side of it, is where I think is even more important, is what, we are seeing here, not only in foreign policy, but in the United States, a revolution in process. And Trump represents a revolutionary class. It's a coalition of anti-bureaucratic, bureaucratic bourgeoisie allied with a kind of resentful petite bourgeoisie and a plutocratic elite. It's a weird mix, but that's who they are. But what they're really against is a class of lawyers, journalists, professors, regulators, institutional actors who are meant to safeguard legitimacy. And so I think of the Trump administration as an anti-legitimacy revolution. They saw their exclusion from cultural power as illegitimate, and they believe they're the rightful elite and resent anyone who will limit them. And legitimacy is simply a mask for the domination of our class, the global elite. And this is a revolution going on, and the Pete Hegseth entry into the military and the Department of War or whatever you want to call it is an attempt to say that the norms of professionalism and human rights and that you have to follow rules are a kind of imposition and domination by a global class of legitimists, and we're going to return to a different version of America. And it's a real version of America, which hates institutions when those institutions seem illegitimate and take away the sort of rough and tumble of American democratic ideas. And we have to understand that we're seeing a revolution going on in the country and not get distracted from that by the day-to-day barrage.
When it comes to the day-to-day barrage, I mean, how much of this also is I don't want to be cynical, but it does seem to be time to be a diversion too, doesn't it?
Well, every day is another diversion. So,
right.
I mean, the sort of flood the zone idea, is a diversionary thing, but it's also part of what's going on, right? They want to, if you just keep people talking and flooding the zone every day with more and more excrement, you lose sight of what's actually happening, which is that institutions are being delegitimized. And let's be honest, the institutions were biased and were corrupt, and there's a reason for this happening. And that's why it's so hard to fight it, because you can't just say, let's go back to, the old institutions, because people don't trust them. You have to be willing. The only way to fight this is to some way try and somehow build a consensus around rebuilding new institutions. And that's going to take time.
Jonathan?
I would say some things are being surrendered, right? The Senate and the House are not playing the roles on the check on the Trump administration. I just wanted to pick up on something that Rogers, there's real, you know, I've wanted to say this, Russia has, we have the Monroe Doctrine, Russia has what's affectionately known as the Minsky Doctrine, right, which says that we control this former Soviet space, the 15, geography of the 15 republics which constitute the former Soviet Union. So if you're Ukraine, this is incredibly meaningful because it is signifying, you know, this shift in strategy, which gives the United States control over one part and Russia control of another part. And I think, as you signaled, Roger, Taiwan also very significantly, you know, I would be scared to death if I was in Taiwan right now with this new version of the United States. But I also think, you know, I don't want to give a pass to the folk in the Senate and the House who consistently have surrendered their role as a check on this administration's policies, perhaps because they agree with them, but I'm not sure. I think there's such divisions going on there, but there's certainly a lack of heart. And regardless of whether we can't go back to what existed before, I do think the very absence of checks and challenges on the current administration is incredibly corrosive on a whole host of issues that we'll see come to bear in the coming months and years, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's the rugged individualism and American exceptionalism that started really, I mean, the Tea Party, but before that, since the beginning, since the founding of our country, but that's run amok now. And because we played such a strong leadership role post-World War II in establishing international rules of conflict, this is also a sign that the United States is rewriting the norms for international engagement. And if you're not on our side, the rules will be used against you. The rules will be crossed and redefined in order to exclude you from the global power structure.
Let me add one thing, though, which I would say, which is that the administration isn't stupid. I think Venezuela is, you know, they're a great target. If you look at Freedom House rankings, mm-hmm. Not free, they're incredibly low. There's oppression going on there. If you look at Transparency International, they're amongst the most corrupt regimes. So if you're going to choose a foil to exercise a new version of national security strategy, they're a target, although we hear nothing about talking about once Maduro leaves, if he leaves, right, which is an assumption on their part. And Susie Wiles really, you know, as I think maybe you said that, gave it away yesterday. She said, we're going to keep on blowing up boats until Maduro cries uncle. And people way smarter than me say that he will. Well, I don't know if he will. That isn't his MO. But if he does, what happens next?
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we'll get to, we'll continue this. We'll get to letters and also move on to other stories in the news as well. First, this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a great group this morning, Osman Ahmad, Jonathan Becker, Roger Berkowitz, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. This letter from Russ. So under a mercantile imperialist regime, the United States has control over the resources of the Western Hemisphere. So Russia, in turn, can claim sovereignty over Eastern Europe, and China can enforce rule over Taiwan, if not Japan. This is the world Roosevelt fought to end. Anyone on that?
Well, you know, he may have fought to end it, and we've had 70 or 80 years of a global U.S.-led liberal order. I think anyone who doesn't understand that order is over has not been paying attention. What will replace it and how it will emerge is still obviously unclear, but I think that order is done.
So meanwhile, there is still work being done on the investigation as to boat strikes, and that the concern over these maritime attacks in regards to Venezuela. And so Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth declined on Tuesday, yesterday, to show members of Congress the unedited video of a boat attack in September that included a second strike to kill survivors amid bipartisan pressure for more transparency around the U.S. military's operations in international waters. Mr. Hegseth, who along with Secretary of State Marco Rubio delivered separate classified briefings for all members of the House and Senate, said officials plan to share the video of the September 2nd strike with members of the Congressional National Security Committees, but not more broadly. Of course, we're not going to release a top-secret, full, unedited video of that to the general public, Mr. Hegseth said after the meeting with senators, which was held in the secure briefing room designated to handle top-secret intelligence. The briefings unfolded as members of both parties have raised questions about the nature and legality of the attacks at sea and expressed concern that they were not being given adequate information about them. It came as the Senate was on the brink of giving final approval to a defense policy bill that would freeze part of Mr. Hegseth's travel budget if he failed to give Congress unedited video of all the strikes as well as the orders that led to them. President Trump has claimed the strikes are aimed at targeting narco traffickers seeking to bring fentanyl, which he described this week as a weapon of mass destruction, into the United States. But lawmakers have repeatedly been told that the boats the military has struck since September were carrying cocaine, not fentanyl. There have also been escalating questions about the rules of engagement for the operation, including the legality of the first attack, which included a second strike to kill survivors. Earlier this month, a small group of congressional leaders and senior lawmakers viewed a video of the September 2nd strike that showed a fiery explosion that destroyed most of a vessel in the Caribbean Sea. As the smoke cleared from the first strike, two survivors could be seen clinging to the hull of the capsized vessel, trying unsuccessfully to flip it and to climb on top. All right. What do we make of this, and do you think we'll ever see the video?
Decades from now, maybe. I don't. You know, there are a couple of things happening. There's the wartime powers, whether or not we're in war, whether the president is acting within some other area of authority, Article 2 power or other statutory authorization that allows for the president to unilaterally, without congressional approval, take certain actions in the interest of national security. And all of this rhetoric is factual posturing, whether or not the facts actually exist or whether or not they're true, because the Trump administration is trying to form a predicate for its actions. Once the action's taken, these types of actions, they're pretty permanent. They can only be reviewed later, after the legal authority has been established or disproved, and then in some sort of either international or domestic court, which takes a long time. So they're pushing the envelope of executive authority, which has been the hallmark of this of both Trump administrations around every single issue imaginable. So it's not surprising, and I would be shocked if anyone believes these factual assertions, but whether or not the American public is going to be able to obtain the facts necessary to prove whether or not the administration is telling the truth is like a whole nother barrel of time-intensive tasks. So, yeah, no, they're going to act first, and the global community can ask questions later, and then whether or not there will ever be an accountability, I guess, you know, we won't find out until long after this administration is out of power, if that ever happens.
I do agree with what Sarah just said, and I'd like to connect it to something Roger said earlier in terms of we are thinking about the macro structure and the spheres of influence and power rearranging itself globally. But there's also the other piece of it, which this story sort of highlights. Okay, so the what is changing, the aggregates of power, but how do Americans conduct themselves? Even if they change from an engaged nation versus one that is more aligned to the Monroe Doctrine and spheres of influence, it's still how do you act? And do we have values and do we stick to those values? And I think that this story, it really does highlight, and it's these series of events highlights that. And by the way, they were not just two strikes. They were apparently four strikes.
Right.
So, I mean, whether we will see this or whether people in Congress will be able to view this video, I hope that Congress will be able to do that. But I don't know if the public will ever see all of it or know all of it.
There are just some things that so help me understand this, folks. This line, it came as the Senate was on the brink of giving final approval to a defense policy bill that would freeze part of Mr. Hegseth's travel budget if he failed to give Congress unedited video of all the strikes, as well as the orders that led to them. So is he giving up his budget by doing this? And what exactly does that mean?
I don't think we all know yet. I mean, they did pass the bill, I believe, and the bill does cut. It requires him only to be able to spend 3/4 of his travel budget in 2026. My guess is that doesn't take real become an issue until something like August or September, so we have time to deal it. I mean, I think there's a couple of things. One is, I'm not sure the public should see this video. I mean, I think the damage to the United States, if we release this video, could be astronomical.
Yeah.
And, I think we all have to realize that there are things that sometimes need to be kept secret.
It's not like I want to see it.
No, and I also don't want to see it, but that's a different issue. The fact that they're not allowing the Armed Services Committee of the House and Senate to see it is simply a travesty. I think that it's already been said here, and it's something I've harped on in my appearances here, is that the complete abdication of responsibility by the House and the Senate to control and limit the executive is to me the biggest story in this whole administration. The fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene has now become our standard for people standing up to Donald Trump is, interesting and somewhat shocking. But the fact that here is where Congress stands up. We are going to take off 1/4 of Pete Hegseth's travel budget in 2026. it is so lame. And this is where we're at. Why can't these people in Congress,
like one free bag as opposed to two?
Why can't these people grow some backbone in Congress? There was this interview in the New York Times this week with three senators who have either resigned or are resigning about why people in the Senate simply can't stand up to the president. And they kept talking about how many people and many Republicans really do feel like it's necessary, and yet they won't do it because they're scared. Scared of what? Scared of being primaried? I mean, this is the situation we're in, and it just shows how corrupt the class of leaders we have are. And, my guess is it's going to take a while, but hopefully at some point a younger and different generation is going to get elected. And they're going to fight back, or not. I mean, maybe this is the end of the American idea of separation of powers, and we'll see. But I'm hopeful that this will eventually correct itself as new people run and come in and insist on congressional oversight. But this is really a lame response. That said, after 9 months of no response, the increased Marjorie Taylor Greene, Senator Massey, Congressman Massey and now some senators and congressmen now demanding some responsibility, even votes on war powers, which are not winning but are being held, does show that I think the Trump hold on the Republican Party is slipping, and that's good news. And I'm hoping that some people will eventually stand up to the president.
Jonathan?
Yeah, just on the last point, there will be a tipping point at some point. And when the power of the president, who is a lame duck, regardless of what people say, with new elections coming up, when one imagines that Congress would find a backbone. But let me just say a couple of other things. I am sure if Hegseth runs out of money, that Cash Patel has plenty of a travel budget, which seems to be limitless to lend to him.
Unfortunately, yes.
And I think in this way, it's sort of interesting. There's two things I would say. One of them is that it's fascinating that you have a leadership in the administration, many of whom, like Hegseth, were chosen because of their telegenic capacity, right? And You have these announcements on social media, you know, Patel, you know, shooting out the announcement of the person detained in the murders at Brown. You know, Trump last night, the policy was announced on Truth Social on right. Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And yet we can't possibly show you these videos where we'll show you every other video as soon as it happens to show how strong we are.
Often so that's AI generated. Yes.
I mean, it's interesting that that goes on. But all of this conversation also masks the underlying issue, was that it's not just the killing of these two people. The whole endeavor is, first of all, they're extrajudicial killings, as we heard earlier from Sarah. I mean, these are not, this is, it's not a war, right? This is, these are criminal actions. And second of all, the whole justification is really absurd. Fentanyl does not come, which is now a weapon of mass destruction, does not come from Venezuela. Right. The boats were heading not even towards the United States. Right. And then Trump pardons, you know, the former president of Honduras, Hernandez, who was a major drug dealer, pardons him. So the real underlying issues, you know, there's a host of contradictions. And ultimately, the failure of Congress, I think, as Roger said, to stand up to this is really problematic. But I feel there will be a turning point. And at some point, the floodgates will open because people will be viewing what is next for me and what is next for me when Trump is no longer president. And so I am hopeful that these signs that Roger was referring to are indications of greater resistance to come. You know, Trump's popularity is way underwater. So when do people wake up to this? I don't know when it is, but what I do know is that this whole justification for what's going on there is absurd on its surface and contradicted by the actions of the Trump administration regularly.
So here is an example of a profile in courage before we go to the break. Most Republicans exiting the briefing backed the Trump administration's decision to limit access, citing concerns about the sensitivity of the classified video. Hey, if you don't like the classification, talk to the White House about it, said Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma, a Republican who sits on the Armed Services Committee. He said that after the meeting. Okay.
Yeah, I want to do a book called Profiles in Cowardice. Yeah. And I think it will be a really long tome.
Yes, you might have several.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters and much more right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It's the 17th of December, and we thank you for being with us. Let's go to some letters that we have on the we were just talking about how great I sound. Janice, I think this may be Trump's Bay of Pigs. There seems to be so many attempts to be related to the Kennedy administration. It's weird, and it's a failure, as there is no comparison. That from Janice. John, it is really appalling to hear you claim that there is a valid so-called revolution going on that is embodied by the Trump administration's domestic and international policy. You fail to contextualize that all of what you are talking about has only become possible because of a cynical strategy of lies and misinformation designed to make these people in power filthy rich. Period. It has nothing to do with doing anything for American security or helping the world. That from John.
I didn't say it was a valid or revolution. I wasn't endorsing it. I think though, to not understand the revolutionary claims involved is a mistake. There really is a sense amongst many people in the administration that the United States was taken over by an unjust class of elites and experts who are not democratically elected for the most part, who ran agencies and institutions that had an outsized voice in the country. And they ran the country in a particular way. It was very good for people like me, right? I travel the world. I'm a global citizen. I could go all over, speak English, and people like me and many of us benefited. And I think there's a lot of advantages to the sort of American global system that emerged. But it didn't help many people in America. There were many people in America suffering from profound poverty, profound meaninglessness. They didn't have, you know, most Americans don't have passports. Most Americans don't go to college. There's just, there was a whole class and group of people who left out. And I don't think of the Trump administration as, you know, really having their interests at heart. I'm not trying to say that. I actually do agree with the letter that much of what's going on is simply a power grab by plutocrats and others. I mean, to me, a huge part of what's happening right now is that the class that I have belonged to, and I think most of us here in this room have belonged to, is a class that believes that you follow rules, you have legitimacy, and you follow the law. And that class advantages people who, you know, who know how to use those. What you're seeing with the Trump administration is, and this is why he pardons all these people and pardons the president of Honduras and others, is we want to normalize rule breaking. We want to normalize corruption. We want to normalize theft because, you know, there's some power in that and there's some beauty in that. And there's an American, a whole American tradition of people who break the rules and get ahead. And I think that there is a kind of, I think there's an important revolution going on against legitimacy, in a sense, empowering people who want to not play by the rules and push ahead. And that is that has a long history in America and around the world, the Wild West, stuff like that. And I think to not take seriously the illegitimacy that the system they're fighting against is seen as doesn't mean that we respect or agree with the revolutionary impact of it, but you have to take seriously what's going on.
We were talking early on, and I believe it was Jonathan who brought this up, of talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene of you know, being, was it you that said that?
It was Roger. As much as I hate to admit, my colleague, yes. Roger had the idea.
but you know, becomes the sane one in the room. But on Tuesday, she was on Caitlin Collins's program last night, The Source, and said that Donald Trump has real problems within the Republican Party, adding that the president is out of touch with voters on key issues such as affordability. Green told Caitlin Collins that, quote, the dam is breaking in terms of Trump's hold on support within the party, and that she expects Republicans to struggle in next year's midterm elections. Citing the backlash to Trump's comments on the death of Director Rob Reiner, the 13 House Republicans who voted with Democrats to overturn Trump's executive order on collective bargaining, and Indiana Republicans' rejection of the president's redistricting push, Green says she expected pushback within the party to grow as lawmakers enter the campaign phase for the upcoming elections. I think the midterms are going to be very hard for Republicans. Green said, I'm one of the people that's willing to admit the truth and say I don't see Republicans winning the midterms right now. And that from the CNN interview.
Yeah, I mean, that's some of what I was referring to previously, which is, when does the dam break on this? And it's unclear. Look, they're trying to do everything they can in terms of electoral structures, in terms of redistricting. And we're waiting on the Supreme Court and the Voting Rights Act to see what happens, to try to slant things in such a way that the Republican Party will hold both houses of Congress, if at all possible. And we'll see what happens there. But I do think there are tipping points. I did take heart in the mass criticism of what Trump said about Rob Reiner. And it's so sad that that is a good sign that people showing the slightest bit of decency is a major win for America. And I think getting to what Asmat was saying about values, and it's not just values of rules of law, but it's basic human decency that is violated on a regular basis that is collectively tolerated often by people who, you know, claim a religious manto for what they're doing. And that's very dispiriting. So I hope Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's our new hero, is right.
Yeah,
okay. We're not ready for
politics. Yeah, Roger said it was the new hero. I was just quoting him.
I don't think I said that, but maybe. No, I mean she certainly has shown some gumption in the last month or two, and spoken up for women's rights and spoken up for other things that I thought was important. And by the way, mass, I wish it were a mass. I mean, two politicians criticized Trump over what he said over Reiner, Massey and Green. Who else?
There were many people in the Republican sort of ecosystem
Let's have some senators and congressmen get on board. I mean, it's just amazing the fear and the inability for them to criticize the president is unbelievable to me. By the way, I just want to say there are some people who we should call out who are not cowards. There are judges putting themselves on the line daily in trying to hold up to due process and the rule of law. There are, you know, some mayors and policemen who are really doing an effort and making an effort. And this is the beauty, I think, of the American system, right? We have separation of powers. We have 50 states. We have different – we have counties and cities with police forces and bureaucracies. And I think one of the most important things we all can do is give support and succor to those who are putting their lives and reputations on the line to stand up to these crimes and these terrible policies. And that is something we should do. We should recognize the heroism and the courage where it does exist.
And you would think, if you could agree on anything, it would be filing a double homicide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you would think, but...
a tragic family situation. And Trump aside.
But Sandy Hook.
Yes. Well, that's right.
You had an entire classroom of children taken out, murdered, and people, the reaction, we can't inspire action after that, so.
Well, and look at, I mentioned this the other day, but then look at what Alex Jones and others did in light of that we're still dealing with the consequences of. But also, I mean, just Sunday was horrible. I mean, between the whole weekend, between Brown and Bondi Beach and the Reiners, and if there was ever a time to try to bring people together, well, that would be it. I think this trio of tragedy, and I agree with Roger. I mean, you find two people, one who's not even going to run again.
Both are not. Marjorie.
Oh, that's right. Massey are not going to run again.
Or is Massey running?
I thought so, but
he's running, but he's being primaried, or is he? I'm sorry, I don't.
We'll check it during the break. We will fact check during the break. I promise. We'll be back. Speaking of a break, we'll take one. We'll be back and continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you here. We thank you for being with us. We have an amazing panel this morning. Osman Ahmad is with us, specialist in government and public services healthcare consulting. Jonathan Becker joins us, executive vice president for academic affairs at Bard College and director for the Center for Civic Engagement, as well as a professor of political studies. Roger Berkowitz is founder and academic director for the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. And Sarah Rogerson, Albany Law School professor and director of the Edward Swire Justice Center at Albany Law. We welcome you, panel at WAMC. I'm just Joe. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's talk about Kash Patel.
There's a wine going up in the room here.
No, Jay. I know. I find it just, look, what happened at Brown University is a tragedy, but we saw this even with the investigation of Charlie Kirk, and we've seen it here now, the FBI director is coming under scrutiny for many who have to, mostly coming from people who have to work with him, it seems to be. Mm-hmm. And as the search for the perpetrator of the fatal shooting at Brown University continues, FBI Director Kash Patel's handling of the high-profile crime is drawing criticism from many. Patel's announcement on social media that the FBI had detained a person of interest Sunday, only for that person to be released hours later with seemingly no connection to the attack at all, echoed a similar miscue in the investigation into the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk in September. I'm breaking into this story that I'm reading from the Boston Globe, but I was fascinated last night as I was looking through because, there are these all the aggregators and so forth, and I was on, I think, Yahoo News, and there's a piece there that came up, and it said, man detained in Brown shooting, and I thought, oh, mm-hmm. Is there another person been? Mm-hmm. And no, it was the going back to the article that was published on Sunday with all of the details, the guy's name, mm-hmm. That he was from Wisconsin, that he was expected to go to the university in the fall. And so this guy is like, once you release that information, that's out. Mm-hmm. There's nothing you're going to do to take that back. Patel's announcement on social media that the FBI had detained a person of interest is certainly something that is being scrutinized, as is the fact on Tuesday they posted a compilation of security camera footage of the suspect. It also included the home addresses of the people whose footage was collected. So if you had your Ring door camera or your camera on your house, it also had your address on it and exactly where you were. So that was deleted after a bit. And after about an hour later, the FBI reposted a version with the addresses, thankfully, removed. It's just another demonstration of how completely unqualified he is and how he has to be removed from this position, said Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat, of Patel's Sunday Post and the person in custody. In this instance, it led people to believe that the culprit had been caught, which reduced everyone's attention for that time period where, perhaps, with a little more focus, the person could have been apprehended. Democrats such as Markey have been critical of Patel since before he was even nominated, with some feuds dating back to when he was a House staffer during the first Trump administration. But it's his handling of the Brown investigation that has inflamed the long simmering frustration with his tenure atop the country's top law enforcement agency. Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed made a point to laud the local FBI officials. While being critical of Patel, the premature leak of information was unfortunate. The first priority is to capture the real perpetrator, and the second priority is to notify the public you have. And I think he reversed that order. Reed, who did not vote for Patel's confirmation, said Patel has been a departure from a tradition of FBI directors with lengthy experience in law enforcement and an aversion to publicity. And we're not even getting into all of the other stories about Cash Patel and investigations and lawsuits that are taking place within the office over his security detail and so forth. But keeping it for a moment focused on this, because we are now entering our fifth day after the Brown shooting, still with a with someone out there at large that has not been brought in, at least not to our knowledge at this point, and still waiting for the idea of still waiting for information as to what is happening within that investigation.
There are thousands of law enforcement officials who are in earnest doing their jobs and trying to do their jobs under corrupt, incompetent leadership. So it's another story that is a through line from all of our conversations this morning, where the president puts people in power as favors or to curry favor. Apparently, Cash Patel is very close with Stephen Miller, and Stephen Miller gets to call a lot of wild and crazy shots. There's the power structure of the administration, and then there are career government employees who are actually responsible for getting the work done. And those two things are increasingly at odds with one another. But the day-to-day government workers and in what some might call patriots are not in power, right? They are unfortunately beholden to this current corrupt power structure. I don't know what else there is to say about Kash Patel that hasn't already been said. And it's not astonishing. It's just, this is what we need to come to expect, I guess, from this leadership. And I don't know what sort of critical mass can form that ends up getting him out of office. But I was thinking about our conversation around Pete Hegseth, and there were articles of impeachment introduced in the House by a Democratic representative from Michigan. So I think there are seeds. There must be other seeds being planted by really well-intentioned actors in this space. We just have to wait and suffer until until those seeds are able to bear fruit, maybe after the midterm elections.
I think the other piece that's very troubling in another way that I look at, whether it's Pete Hegseth or Kash Patel, is this, and maybe it comes from a lack of competence in their domain, is this adherence to almost performative leadership. I mean, there is no need in a role such as the leadership of the FBI to immediately put out information that has not been thoroughly checked and appropriately timed. I mean, this is an intensely managed process. So to have someone who has some sort of adherence to want to be seen to do things more so than actually doing them is a dangerous place for all of us.
Hegseth, we read the quote earlier today, mm-hmm. and said, we are not going to show a video of this classified nature to the public, said the man who shared information on a bombing to a reporter and to his family members.
Correct.
But
in a Signal chat.
Yes.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Very secure.
You know, but please, there's security at stake.
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, as a senior university administrator, I want to just say the sympathies to the family of Brown
Absolutely.
University. My brother's an alum. We were following this on Saturday night. It is tragic. It is tragic for the young people who passed away, who were injured, for the whole community, which has been sundered. That tragedy or responding to the tragedy or coping with the tragedy is not enhanced by a failure in leadership like we saw from Kash Patel. And I would simply say to what Asma said, when you're selecting people who are chosen not on competence, but on telegeneity, on their media personalities, you will get things like this. I would also say two other things that are important. Trump said yesterday, this is a school problem. Right. Oh. So he was pointing the finger at the Brown administrators, and that's obviously ridiculous and unfortunate. But I think the bigger issue, the bigger concern is not his day-to-day activities, but what's going on at the FBI, where you have senior leaders being removed or stepping down. You have a focus on this proximate immigration issue, which is taking away from things like counterintelligence, focusing on Iran, Russia, China. You have a diminishment of cybersecurity. You have a diminishment of election security. All of these things are going on under the surface. So what we're seeing there is just, that is the visual manifestation of the incompetence. But underneath that, the deeper issue is what is not simply the politicization of the FBI, but the defanging of very important things which are relevant to the security of this country. And that is the deeper tragedy. I think Patel only won by a tie-breaking vote in the Senate by J.D. Vance. And one would hope that there would opposition would rise more to this. And if this short-term thing is what leads to that, that would be great. But it is a real tragedy what's going on in the FBI as a whole.
Pleasure.
I mean, it's hard to take Kash Patel seriously. I mean, the man's claim to fame is that he sold Trump merchandise on, for money. Well, I can't blame Kash Patel. He's a charlatan who's been put into this position. I blame the Senate. I blame the people in the Senate. Yes, it was a tie-breaking vote, but the fact that only two or three Republicans voted against him is just a complete condemnation of the leadership class in this country. I think when I talked about a revolution earlier, The thing about a revolution is it attracts intellectuals. It attracts those who understand that the system is corrupt. It attracts those who understand that to some degree you need to destroy things in order to reform them. But at some point, right, when you get people in power and all they do is put in place loyalists and charlatans, you know, the intellectuals and the politicians and the leaders have to be able to stand up and say no. And the complete abdication of authority, I mean, is an indictment of our leadership class. And that's where that's what really bothers me as much as almost anything else in this system, aside from what Jonathan said, which is the tragedy of what happened at Brown and the fact that we really do. We used to have a government that was respected for trying to do things right. And right now it's a laughingstock.
I do. This is to something that Sarah mentioned, but, you know, there are so many women and men out there who are working so hard on this case. Mm-hmm. And in some corners are being ridiculed for not getting to the bottom of it and finding a suspect, but it just seems that it's well, Keystone Cops comes to mind, but it's not their fault, mm-hmm. because the leadership is just whacking, and now there just seems to be a hands off, like, okay, well, you all do what you do. And we'll wait and see what happens until they probably find somebody, and then they'll come in on a white horse and say we were responsible.
Correct. Yeah, they bank on the well-intentioned career government agents who have dedicated their lives in public service in order to catch their moment of power, glory, fame, headlines. Whatever it is, I mean, it's very hard not to be cynical, right now. But I do know. I mean, these agents. I've worked with many FBI agents on different issues, from human trafficking to, you know, the investigation around the Oxford, Michigan high school shooting that my nephew was involved in, and they. It's not that they're not trying hard. It's that when there is a failure in leadership, the access to information, the speed with which that information is conveyed, the interdepartmental communications that need to occur, the interagency communications that need to occur are frustrated by the public statements of buffoons who have been placed in power for no other reason than they curried favor with the president.
He did write an excellent children's book also called The Plot Against the King. Roger forgot to mention that, so he's, you know, noticed for many things other than his selling the cash activities. I want to say one other thing, though, which is that, you know, and this is like a bit of in Russia, you have kritika, samokritika, self-criticism. So I was on Sunday morning Googling to see, you know, did they find, you know, somebody, who is the person of interest? Have they identified them? And I think that there is, in the age of social media, a heightened expectation of knowing about things quickly. But that's precisely when you need good leadership, right? Mm-hmm. To not
yes.
fall prey to those worst sentiments. So it's particularly unfortunate in these circumstances, the way
there should be a media freeze while the investigation is right. underway.
Well, and also, and I think the words of those in the mayor's office, those words from those at Brown University, the Providence, Rhode Island police, and the police agencies in and around that area who are assisting, who have nothing but praise for those agents, the FBI agents, the local agents, who are there working. I mean, they're very clear on where their anger and concern is directed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an interesting thing, just one other thing, which is that the brand of many of the people who are senior in the White House. So Hegseth has his brand, Kash Patel has his brand, Dan Bongino has his brand. And there is something when they're all trying to assert their brand, which is for now and the future, that will lead to clashes amongst them. And I think the Susie Wiles interview that happened yesterday is an indication that not all is copacetic within the leadership team at the White House. So there's something about that which pits people against each other, which, not to diminish the incompetence involved in that, but the eagerness to promote oneself does place people in competition with each other.
Okay. Let's talk about Susie Wiles. I find this story so interesting on so many different counts. But one is, and before we get into it, just to what Jonathan was just saying, do you all agree with me that in the first Trump administration, that if any of these things happened with Hegseth or Patel or Susie Wiles, they would have been gone? I mean, that seemed to be the way it was playing out in the first administration. And now, it just, nothing seemed, okay, they're doing their job, everything's fine.
I think it's fundamentally different, right? The first administration, a lot of the people he appointed had qualifications. And they
which
were,
makes us sadder. And
they, obviously, that was the problem.
And they actually thought they were there to do a job for the American people. This is a fundamentally different administration. He said very clearly, I learned from the first time I appointed people who were not loyalists mm-hmm. and who, you know, had other ideas besides serving me. This is one where the people he's appointed are loyalists. He trusts them. They are obsequious to him. And I just don't think he has, you know, and so as long as, you know, he trusts, you know, I think Susie Wiles says to him, look, you told me to talk to these people because, and I talked to them for 11 whatever hours or whatever, and this is what they chose to print. You know, she's loyal to him, and he's going to be loyal to her. She's actually probably the most competent person amongst all of them.
I agree.
But the point is, this is an administration fully based on loyalty, not on competence, whereas the first Trump administration, a lot of the people there were actually competent people, and there's a fundamental difference there.
Mm-hmm. I would say a veneer of competence, right? Like,
well, some of the people were good people in the first administration, right? And they held them in check or tried to. I mean,
yeah.
I think the most interesting one is John Kelly, right? So yeah. The chief of staff, the analog to Susie Wiles. And I think what came out in that interview, I read only the first half, was that she views her job largely as executing the wishes of the president and not really challenging. Occasionally she challenges them, but not on a regular basis. And John Kelly, who served in the military previously, he did question and challenge the president, and they did put the brakes on beneath him. What I read was a very tight group of people in this, which is you know, Rubio, J.D. Vance, Trump, Susie Wiles, and Stephen Miller are the inner sanctum, which is making decisions, and that does not fill me with confidence. I also thought it was just fascinating how in unison the administration came in defense of Susie Wiles. It was really amazing. And the most important thing, which Joe pointed out when we weren't on air, is that Susie Wiles is Pat Summerall's daughter. That was truly the most amazing thing.
What I learned from this whole thing, really, is I didn't know that. Also, you know, but the idea that this was, I mean, Trump, of course, is painting it as a reporter who had an agenda and was miscommunicating and taken out of context and so forth, and he didn't read it, and da-da-da-da-da. There were, like, five photo shoots. Annie Leibovitz came in and did five photo shoots of all of these people that they're talking about. They all had say in this over a really long period of time. And I'm sorry, as an interviewer, I think most people get a pretty good idea of where somebody is going by the questions that are being asked and the answers that are being given.
Yeah. Charles Barkley once famously said, I was misquoted in my own autobiography. So it just seems, you know.
Well, he did have a ghostwriter.
and
that's just when the stories that we tell about ourselves are placed in the hands of other people and then they go differently than we had anticipated.
Yeah.
That's what this is.
Yep. But I do think, well, interestingly, I thought a bit about her last name and how sometimes we find people like Jamie Dimon, like Susan Wiles. I mean, I think from the interview, I came away thinking this is a remarkable woman.
Wiley.
Mm? Yes.
Yeah, I love it.
And there's a piece in the Vanity Fair article about how she's just off camera. You know, we heard in the first administration, we were talking about this as to how visible people were or that they had their point of view. She has not been visible to me as an ordinary observer. And that is competence. It is, mm-hmm. whether, you know, to what end is, and we may not agree with some of those directions, but it is. And it, I do agree with you that it it worried me to listen to the characterizations of the small inner group of people that are driving the decisions.
For those who may not be aware, Wiles offered an unvarnished description of her professional relationship with Trump. She said he has an alcoholic's personality, which is how Pat Summerall came off, because she said she recognized that from her own father. She got into a fight with the president, an explosive outburst in over Florida poll numbers at Trump's Miami Golf Club in the fall of 2016. Wiles told Vanity Fair he berated her for more than an hour. He was ranting and raving, and I didn't know whether to argue back or whether to be stoic. What I really wanted to do was cry. After the confrontation, Wiles said, she told Trump, if you want somebody to set their hair on fire and be crazy, I'm not your girl. But if you want to win this state, I am. It's your choice. She referred to herself as a little bit of an expert in big personalities, described Trump as having an alcoholic's personality, saying he operates with a view that there's nothing he can't do, nothing, zero, nothing. Wiles said she urged Trump not to pardon the most violent rioters from the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. But after Trump argued that even the violent offenders had been unfairly treated, she sort of got on board. She and Trump, she said, had a loose agreement that the score settling will end before the first 90 days of his presidential term are over. In August, long after those first 90 days had passed, Wiles told Vanity Fair that she did not think Trump was on a retribution tour, but that he believed, quote, people that have done bad things need to get out of the government. In some cases, it may look like retribution, Wiles said, and there may be an element of that from time to time. Who would blame him? Not me, she added. Wiles offered a candid assessment of the administration's handling of files related to Jeffrey Epstein. Attorney General Pam Bondi, Wiles said, completely whiffed in handling the Epstein files. First, she gave them binders full of nothingness, referring to the binders handed to conservative influencers. And then she said that the witness list or the client list was on her desk. There is no client list, and it sure as hell wasn't on her desk. And then there was much, much, much more. But we'll take a quick break. We'll talk a little bit more about this on the other side. And as we move through this morning, we welcome you, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And before we get to all of that, we'll take a break and get a news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Quick fact check that was done during the break. Jonathan mentioned to me that I was reading one of the previous articles that claimed that Annie Leibovitz was the photographer for the Vanity Fair profile done on Susie Wiles. She was not. It was Christopher Anderson was the photographer of that. And the journalist, who I should have mentioned also, who did the interviews and did the piece in Vanity Fair, is Chris Whipple. So stand corrected on that. Let's see. I think we have, I thought we had letters. Maybe we don't. All right. Did anybody else want to say anything else about this before we move on to something else?
I'll say one thing. I sort of think that the chattering classes, us, me, are getting this wrong. I don't think this is going to look so bad for a lot of people, what she said. When she, you know, the alcoholic personality thing is the thing I've seen most quoted in sort of things.
Right.
You know, everyone knows Trump doesn't drink. I think it sort of looks good that he's an alcoholic personality who doesn't drink. He's someone who has a big personality. There's nothing he can't do. I think this appeals to a lot of people in his class. And there's a sort of a gotcha element to a lot of this that I think appeals to some of us, but is not going to have that same resonance to a lot of people watching it. I will say this one thing that, you know, I found one of the interesting parts of the article where Susie Wiles said that she tried to sort of argue to Trump that some of the most violent January 6th people should be pardoned. And he said, well, you know, they were treated unfairly. And she said, I sort of accept part of that. And here's where, you know, I really do see what's going on. The prosecutions against Trump, I mean, Trump was guilty of a lot of things, but the prosecutions against him were seen as, and I think rightly seen as, unfair by many people. And that has, and that sort of corruption of the institutions has, is what has given a lot of middle-of-the-road intellectuals the sort of cover, like Susie Wiles, to work for Trump, even though they think he's uncouth, boorish, and dangerous in many ways. They see it necessary to break up that system. And that's what I was saying before, that the breaking up of an unjust system or a corrupt system is very attractive to a lot of intellectuals and artists, etc. And yet they often get caught up in it and they forget how dangerous it is. And I think that's unfortunately where we are with her.
I think there's something else. So just one thing there. If I recall the article correctly, what it said is that Trump said that some of the most violent January 6th offenders had already served the sentences recommended by that's the correct. Normal standards. Mm-hmm. And the author, Chris Whipple, put parenthetically, and that's not true, right? They hadn't, right? So the whole supposition of that was wrong. And that speaks to this other thing, which is how easily people compromise any principles that are involved and how they justify that. And the justification might be because we have to change the system, or the justification might be because people think, well, if I'm not here, someone worse will be here and even worse things will happen. And I think these compromises, the lesser of two evils, goes on regularly in Congress, in the Senate, in the administration. And that is really at what point will people look evil in the eye and say, this is what's going on? And that to me is the real question.
As Hannah Arendt said, we should always forget that the lesser evil is still evil. And that is something that is, I think, clearly being forgotten right now.
All right, let's move on to other topics, and we go to the travel ban that has been expanded. This, of course, comes after President Trump on Tuesday expanded travel restrictions to include 20 more countries, just weeks after he promised to do so. Trying to cough. When authorities arrested an Afghan national in the shooting of two nationals. Can't help it. There we go. When authorities arrested an Afghan national in the shooting of two National Guard troops in Washington. The revised policy, which takes effect on January 1st, fully blocks travel for individuals from five additional countries: Syria, South Sudan, Mali, Burkina Faso, as well as Niger, and also for people with documents issued by the Palestinian Authority. The Trump administration also added partial travel restrictions for the individuals from 15 additional countries, predominantly in Africa. With the expansion, there are now more than 35 countries with U.S. travel restrictions. Sarah, what should we make of this?
Well, and just to make matters worse, the new policy also applies to spouses, children, and parents of U.S. citizens, which is kind of notable and somewhat exceptional. It bars siblings and adult children of U.S. citizens, as well as international students, which is something I'm sure a lot of us around the table are going to have to sort out with regard to students who travel here for an education. But as has been the case, these pronouncements create a lot of confusion on the ground, not just for people who are trying to move in order to do their job or their duty in some cases. It also causes confusion among the bureaucracy charged with implementing these laws, which often under this administration results in an over-enforcement. So there's the intent, which is clearly to continue on Stephen Miller's platform of isolationism and hate, really targeted hate, real clear messages about who belongs in the United States and who doesn't, and further erosion of what U.S. citizenship even means and how much power the executive has over stripping any of us of it. I don't mean to be hyperbolic. This is just, it's not hyperbole anymore.
Jonathan?
I mean, Trump's entire career has been built off of attacking dark-skinned people, right? Whether they're in the United States or elsewhere. He called people from Somalia garbage the other day. You know, he started out in the Central Park Five, and he, you know, Obama over not being a citizen. This is brand. It's not just brand Stephen Miller. It's brand Trump.
Yeah.
And I mean, just the two things I would say. One of them is the very positive thing. I want to call out Ahmed Al-Ahmed, who was the immigrant from Syria, who was in Australia, who tackled one of the shooters the other day on Bondi Beach. And so we don't hear about the heroic immigrant. We only hear about those who might commit crimes, fictitious otherwise, or eat dogs or whatever have you. But this is corrosive in what's really, as a teacher, as an educator, I work with students from some of these countries and other countries on ban lists, and to see the corrosive impact on young people who have idealized this country in many ways, who have come here because they actually believe in it, who aspire to a better future, and who on a daily basis are feeling, you see it in the illnesses that they have, you see it in their faces and the things that they write, and it's just a real tragedy. But it is brand Trump. This is totally on message for him, and it's extremely unfortunate.
I do want to pick up on what Sarah was saying with regard to this being a slippery slope, and you know, it doesn't take very much. People may say that here, let's say that they don't know anyone from Zambia or why, you know, someone from Tonga may want to come to this country. Another way that some of these things translate into the community that's already here is that it creates fractions within the community here as well. So, yes, they may, you know, someone may just see a brown person, a dark-skinned person. They don't know the difference or may not even care to know the difference because there is this sense of fear being instilled of people now from a great number of countries. So how do I know that this person is not from there? And so therefore now should I just as a precautionary attitude be staying away from a lot of people? So it's not only not exercising the humanitarian values of this country, but it is also creating fractures in the communities where we live. And that's a cost we start to pay the moment something like this comes about. And I think that is tragic for our communities.
Absolutely. Roger?
Yeah, I'll just add that everything I've said, I mean, this is an affront and an attack on exactly what, to me, are American values. And it's sad. The other part of it that I don't know if it's been mentioned is that we now, they're using this as an excuse to delay citizenship ceremonies, to delay and stop asylum claims that are in process. So you have people in detention, like one of our students, Ali Farquhazad, who I guess now will have his asylum claims delayed. Is that?
There's a lot going on with it.
Okay, I don't know. But, I mean, people in detention waiting for asylum claims are now going to have their asylum claims denied or delayed. And this seems to me, again, an attack on the very basic, not only institutions and rule of law, but the idea of neighborliness and sanctuary that I believe America stands for. So it's deeply disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the people came here with a promise of the U.S. government for a pathway to citizenship. And they did that because of the relationship with the U.S. government or the relationship to U.S. values. And to have come here and come very long ways to get to the United States and then have the rug pulled out in the middle of that is really saddening, troubling. And getting back to what Asma talked about, values, if this is a shift in values or the revolution in values, to say we don't value principles right now. We just value power.
I mean, they're reopening validly filed green card applications. It's very, very bad. I don't know. This is why I can't. In 20 years, it's never been this bad.
And detaining people, green card holders on domestic flights are being detained and interviewed.
Yep.
And it's unimaginable.
And I'm not putting you on the spot to get into any specifics, but with your BART student, your student who is being held, do you get a sense that, from the outside, my sense is that BART is doing a lot in helping and doing what it can. What do people do who don't have that?
Yeah, that's the...
I hear from them every day.
I understand, and wonderful people who are lawyers who are involved in this area are inundated. And what we as an institution could do with, we have many people might be infected with this. And even internally, I wonder, how are we going to deal if there's a flood? But absolutely the case. The same thing I said to you, we began talking about voting rights. We've been very involved in voting rights for an educated, mobilized, resource rich comparatively population to defend that. Yeah, what do people do in other circumstances? It is really, really tragic. And these communities who have come here because they idealize the life in the United States and because many of them believe in American values. And that is the great tragedy, I think, here. Some of the people who are most believe in the United States are the ones who are having the door slammed in their face and being treated horrifically, as Ali Farkazada is.
We have a couple of letters and a couple of topics to discuss. We'll take a break and we'll wrap up the show. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I have a couple of miscellaneous letters I'd like to get to as we wrap up our time together in our final 8 or 9 minutes. Let's see. This from Doug. After his ridiculous and incorrect statements in the Charlie Kirk murder and then in the Brown University killings, I think it's time for Trump to accept Kash Patel's resignation, whether or not he offers it, or especially if he doesn't. His entire time in his current role has been spent begging for attention as the person who resolved all the problems, while he has been doing the exact opposite. Meanwhile, Marion writes to us on the Susie Wiles article and says, if Susie Wiles actually believes anything she is saying, she has no clue about the mental illness she is dealing with in Trump. He can't help it. Revenge is the nature of his malignant narcissism, and it gets worse with time and with power. War, aggression, violence, lawlessness, cruelty, and accusing others of what he himself is doing is also part of the illness. We then check in with Peter, also on Susie Wiles, who says, I think that Susie Wiles wanted what she said to get out, which is why she agreed to be interviewed so many times. But then, of course, she had to attack the article to give herself some cover. It was like she was saying, I'm shocked to think that he would actually publish what I had to say. Then in a note that is subject-lined bias in the U.S., bias is everywhere, unfortunately. I guess now that we will go back to the bias our country has experienced for an eternity in favor of white Christian males. I am hoping that the days of incremental reform for the rights and freedoms of women and people of color is not over. We can only hope. Those are the letters that I have in – oh, actually, one more. This from Chuck. Next time there's a mass shooting, rather than lowering flags to half-staff, we should just run up a white flag because we have surely surrendered to the NRA. That from Chuck. Let's – the president is going to speak to the nation tonight at 9 o'clock.
What does Why? That mean?
I now
on,
we don't
on
really
Truth
know.
Social or something
yes,
else.
Yes, no. I think on actual. Now there is some question as to who is going to cover it. There is some question as to, now, as in many cases of this presidency, normally, if a president said there was going to be an address in the Oval Office, they would sit behind the desk, they would read the teleprompter, and it would be a short mostly short, concise speech about something that was happening within our nation that we were dealing with at that particular time. This, so far, from what I have been able to glean, is going to be, and Carolyn Leavitt is the one who said, the spokesperson for Trump, who said that, gave a sense of as to what the speech would be about, said that this would look as a report card on the accomplishments of the past year since January 20th, 2025 to current day, and also a look into the future. I will note, not at all sarcastically, but I will note that that was a similar goal that was mentioned as the speech that he gave in Pennsylvania last week on affordability at a casino in the Poconos.
Yes.
So, and wasn't that? No. It was just an airing of grievances, which I, you know, and so I know that
that's usually what happens in the casinos in the Poconos.
That's true. That's right.
Isn't it the festivus season though? So
it
I mean,
is.
We should.
It is. You're absolutely right. I was interested to hear that NPR made the decision that they are not going to be offering coverage of it. They will cover it during the newscast, and they will covered during the news magazines, but they will not be offering live, unanchored coverage of it. I think that says a lot, but I also think that other news organizations are having the same issue. I mean, will you see the programming of ABC, NBC, or CBS sidelined as for this? I don't know. I haven't seen the official announcements yet.
Don't we have the State of the Union next month? I think it
is,
right? Look, he is brilliant at using media and getting us to focus on the other things, right? The Epstein files are being released Friday. We have Venezuela going on. We have this. We'll see what he does. But Donald Trump has been an incredibly effective manipulator of media, you know, and we'll see. Pennsylvania speech notwithstanding. But I have to say, for at least in my household, I don't think it's must-see TV.
Well, I just think we all know what it's going to be, right? I mean, whether you're a supporter of the president or you're not a supporter of the president, I think you have an idea of what it's going to be. And we've seen this movie a lot, where you get up and you say, these are all the wonderful things that I've done. And
then something probably wildly off script that people will talk about until Christmas.
Did you all hear the snake story?
Mm. No.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, the other day he was in an event and started to talk about for 11 minutes talked about snakes.
No.
And this was during his Christmas address on the first day of Hanukkah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And but it was.
Oh, I did, because my kids were playing me the playback on TikTok. Because these things become like internet sensations immediately.
Well, why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, he was talking about the brown and black black mamba and vipers, and then he did like a viper. He did a viper mimic of the viper coming of the teeth coming out, and it was apparently about a doctor that he saw in the audience, who had gone on an excursion with the Obama children. To Peru, and told this story about being attacked by these snakes, to which I believe he claimed somewhere over 230,000 people died each year as a result of the snake bites. Quick fact check said that over the last 20 years, there have been 10 deaths.
Right.
So that kind of stuff.
Snakes on a plane.
Right.
With a president.
Well, Anaconda is coming out this Friday, so there you go. I am interested. Oh, no. So I am interested to see. There is that morbid curiosity too as to what's going to be said,
and how much money it's going to make him.
Yes, there is that.
I mean, as Susie Wiles said, Trump has an incredible alcoholic's personality, right? He thinks he can solve any problem. he clearly sees things slipping right now. We've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he thinks a direct address to the American people will allow him to reconnect and bond. And we'll see.
From the diplomatic reception room instead of the Oval Office? What is that all about?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Karen Levitt says, though, that it's, if in case you have any doubts, it's going to be a really good speech.
he could do it from the construction site for the new ballroom.
Yes. I was just in the Oval Office with the president discussing it. He's going to talk a lot about the accomplishments over the last 11 months, all that he's done to bring our country back to greatness, and all he continues to plan to do to continue delivering for the American people over the next 3 years. Levitt said that Trump is likely to talk about issues such as border security and the economy, and I think we could probably guarantee that is the case. So we will,
amongst other things that we will be surprised by.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and as that happens, I'm sure we'll have plenty to discuss on tomorrow's roundtable program, and we welcome you to join us for that proceeding. In the meantime, a good way of shaking off what we've been talking about over the last 2 hours is that we're about to present Itzhak Perlman's Hanukkah radio party. So get ready for that.
Ooh.
It's a party, and we're going to be presenting that in just a few moments. Before we head over to that, though, let me take a moment to thank all of our wonderful panelists, Osman Ahmad, Jonathan Becker, Roger Berkowitz, Sarah Rogerson. You are all wonderful. Thank you so much for your time and your thoughts and your wisdom. I greatly appreciate it. Be well. We will continue with Itzhak Perlman's Hanukkah radio party next on WAMC.